listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. As part of the Odyssey Project, you might have also heard the English poet Alice Oswald last month, or this month actually, recite from memory her poem, Memorial, which is an oral history of those soldiers who Homer recorded as dying in the Trojan War. The deaths that Oswald describes, those who survived the war must have witnessed those deaths, are deeply disturbing. They're very vivid. We think of the warrior Odysseus on his long journey home from that battle, and think about it. What horrific images of war did he carry in his soul? How had that war transformed him? When we ask young men and women to go to war, what are we asking of them? When their deployments end and they return, many of them changed forever, how do they recover some facsimile of normalcy? How does their experience impact their families? And I can personally attest, as the daughter of a Pacific War vet, that my childhood was shaped by my father's traumatic combat experiences in the Philippines. And there are more Iraq and Afghanistan vets returning to California, to our state, than to any other state in the Union. What are they facing, and how might we as a community assist those veterans? Tonight, we'll discuss those crucial issues with two of our very distinguished guests, MacArthur Award-winning author David Finkel and pioneering clinical psychologist Albert Skip Rizzo. From here on out, he's Skip. For his deeply affecting book, Thank You for Your Service, David Finkel embedded with the struggling veterans of the 216 Infantry Battalion, dispatched to Iraq during the infamous surge, after they returned home from the front lines in Baghdad. And Skip Rizzo, director for medical virtual reality at the Institute for Creative Technologies at USC, treats veterans, returning veterans suffering from PTSD with his pioneering use of virtual reality-based exposure therapy. I'm just going to give brief bios for our guests. They are both very illustrious in their fields. David Finkel is a staff writer for the Washington Post. He's also the leader of the Post's national reporting team. He received the Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting in 2006, and he's also the author of The Good Soldiers, a contemporary classic on the Iraq War. His book, Thank You for Your Service, is a stunning immersion into the reality of veterans' return from the war. Skip Rizzo is director of medical virtual reality at USC Institute for Creative Technologies. He's also a research professor with the USC Department of Psychiatry and at the USC Davis School of Gerontology. And he's the recipient of the American Psychological Association's Award for Outstanding Contributions for the Treatment of Trauma. And our wonderful interlocutor tonight is journalist Thomas Kerwin, an award-winning staff writer at the Los Angeles Times, whose stories are characterized by their immersion research, by their lyricism, and by their compassion. Kerwin's work was a 2008 finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Please join me in welcoming our distinguished guests. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Louise. Welcome, everybody. It's nice to see you out here this evening. I think we all should give a round of applause to Louise and the Library Foundation for bringing this thing together. It's really remarkable. Out in the lobby, you'll probably, if you haven't already, I'd recommend that you join the Library Foundation. It's a really wonderful organization that makes these talks possible to all of us downtown. I always think about these things, you know, if one day we didn't come to the library to see these loud talks, what a gap there'd be in our lives here in downtown and the culture of Los Angeles. So I encourage you to support it. It's great to see everybody here this evening. So I'm curious to find out how many of you participated at all in the Odyssey over the last month or so. That's a good show of hands. And then to refine it a little bit for this evening. Veterans in the audience? Excellent. Excellent. We will, at the end of our conversation, we're going to have a Q&A, and we invite your questions. What you bring to these conversations are always really enlightening and really helpful and open up the doors to our own sort of thoughts, and we welcome that as well. When I first heard about this project that the library is putting together to couple the Odyssey with the notion of veterans returning from the war, much like Louise's opening comments, I was really intrigued. It opened up a book, a text that I'd been reading, you know, on and off in the course of my life, and never quite thought about its relevancy to our current wars. The notion that Ulysses was a soldier returning from a war, the sense that his 10-year journey across the sea to get back to Ithaca might be indeed some form of PTSD, that maybe the Cyclops was a nightmare in his dreams, maybe Scylla and Charybdis was a hallucination derived from the rigors of 10 years of combat against the walls of Troy. His return, the alienation recognized only by his dog, trying to re-win his wife from the suitors, re-familiarize himself from the son, his son, being unrecognized by his countrymen and his country. I found really it opened up a new dimension to this book that I hadn't considered. And I think that's sort of the fun way to sort of begin this conversation. So I guess before we get into the meat and potatoes, I just wanted to ask Skip and David here, you know, your associations with this sort of, you know, perhaps odd but certainly appropriate coupling of the Odyssey with the work that you're doing. David?
Yeah, sure. So when I was, significant and intimidating, those are some words, when I went out to Kansas to begin reporting my second book, Thank You for Your Service, my wife packed something in my suitcase, and when I got to the airport and saw what it was some audio recordings. I put them in as I was driving to Fort Riley, and it turned out to be recordings of the Odyssey. And I had two thoughts. Number one, thanks for the gift, and thanks for setting the bar so high. And, yeah, so, but I listened pretty closely to them, obviously.
Yeah, that's lovely. Sure. And Skip?
I think the important element of it is that PTSD is not a new thing, and the Odyssey wasn't a book written about PTSD, but it was written about a person's experience, and that these experiences weren't new to Vietnam, weren't new to World War I, and they're part of the human condition. And it was a great piece of storytelling, I think, that conveyed a reality that exists today.
Yeah, that's sort of the experience that I had as I was reading it. And I want to touch upon that later. I think the sort of historical perspective of PTSD and the trauma and the 20th century, which certainly brought the words of shell shock and PTSD into our lexicon, I think is quite interesting to try to understand the differences that we might experience in that today and what the past, how the past experienced it as well. So without further ado, let's get our author and our clinical psychologist off to the races here. So David, do you want to begin and perhaps share with us a little bit about Thank You for Your Service, the evolution of the book, where you began, and if you would, I think probably a reading would be lovely.
Terrific. Yes, I'd like to. The background is this. I'm a journalist. The type of journalism I do is... I guess the newest name for it is immersion journalism. It's basically journalism where it's not where something has happened and you go in afterward and you do interviews to try to flush out the story. Rather, nothing has happened yet, but something interests you. In this case, in 2007, when to many people the Iraq War seemed to have reached its lost moment and perhaps its tragic moment, George W. Bush announced the surge, and suddenly 20,000, which turned out to be 30,000 additional troops were on the way, including an infantry battalion from Fort Riley, Kansas, 800 infantry soldiers, most 19, 20 years old, filled with a young man's invincibility, thinking that they were going to go into this thing and win it. And instead, what happened over the course of their deployment is what happens in war. They lost their first guy, their second guy, on and on. The injuries mounted. Invincibility was replaced by a certain transformation, moral injury, in many cases, a kind of moral degradation, I think it's fair to say. I was with them. The journalism, the question I was interested in was, I didn't want to write a book about the Iraq War. What I wanted to write something more intimate, a reported book, a piece of journalism, but that would answer the question, what becomes of someone who goes into a war at such a moment? And my reporting method was to go with them and not to write about me, not to write a polemic, not to declare the war won or lost or the surge a success or failure, but to document what happens in the corner occupied at the far end of policy, the corner occupied by these soldiers. So that was the first book. And they had a tough deployment. Every day wasn't bad, but there was a period, I think it was October 2007, and I was asking around one day, who is a great soldier? Who do I need to meet who I haven't met yet? And there was a junior officer said, well, you got to meet this guy, Adam Schumann. If he's not our best, he's certainly one of our best. Okay, things got a little hot. They calmed down a few weeks later. I went in search of this great soldier, Adam Schumann. I went to his room, and I think we have a slide. And when I walked into his room, the guy I saw waiting for me was that guy. This rather haunted, gaunt-looking man. And I introduced myself, and he kind of said, I guess I know why you're here. And I said, I hear you're a great soldier. And he said, well, maybe, but this is a guy who had been... He was on his third deployment. He had been in combat about 1,000 days at that point. And through an accumulation of events, he couldn't do it anymore. He had cracked open and he was on his way home. And we can argue all night about what we think about these wars, but let's do keep one thing in mind. The soldiers I've written about and who I'll talk about tonight, they did not craft policy. They were the ones carrying out policy. And by every measure, every metric of what makes a great soldier, Adam Schumann was a great soldier. But he was so cloaked in guilt and shame that day. And I stayed with him until he walked to the helicopter out of the war. And there's a very quick description in The Good Soldiers and in the preface of Thank You for Your Service that describes the moment. His stomach hurt as he made his way across the FOB. He felt himself becoming nauseated. At the landing area, other soldiers from other battalions were lined up, and when the helicopter landed, everyone was allowed to board except him. He didn't understand. Next one's yours, he was told. And when it came in a few minutes later, he realized why he'd had to wait. It had a big red cross on the side. It was the helicopter for the injured and the dead. That was him, Adam Schumann. He was injured. He was dead. He was done. And he left the war. I stayed, I finished the book. After the book came out, I began hearing from guys they weren't doing so hot, getting in fights, getting drunk, arguing, couldn't sleep, so on, including Schumann. So I decided, if I'm such a hotshot journalist, finish the story, write the second volume, the story of the afterwar, the ongoing story. And at its center is Adam Schumann, and this is very briefly the excerpt I'd like to read.
Please.
And it's how the book begins.
Of course.
2 years later, and when I say 2 years later, I'm talking about 2 years after that photograph. 2 years later, Adam drops the baby. The baby, who is 4 days old, is his son, and there is a moment as he is falling that this house he has come home to seems like the most peaceful place in the world. Outside is the cold dead of 3 a.m. on a late November night in Kansas, but inside is lamplight, the warm smell of a newborn, and Adam's wife, Saskia, beautiful Saskia, who a few minutes before had asked her husband if he could watch the baby so she could get a little sleep. I got it, he'd said. Get some rest. She curled up in the middle of their bed, and the last thing she saw was Adam reclined along the edge, his back against the headboard and the baby in his arms. He was smiling as if contentment for this wounded man were possible at last, and she believed it enough to shut her eyes just before he shut his. His arms soon relaxed. His grip loosened. The baby rolled off of his chest and over the edge of the bed. And here came that peaceful moment. The baby in the air. Adam and Saskia asleep. everyone oblivious, the floor still a few inches away, and now, with a crack followed by a thud, the moment is over and everything that will happen is underway. Saskia is the one who hears it. It is not loud, but it is loud enough. Her eyes fly open. She sees Adam, closed-eyed and empty-armed, and only when he feels the sharp elbows and knees of someone scrambling across him does he wake up from the sleep he had promised he didn't need. It takes him a second or two, then he knows what he has done. He says nothing. There's nothing he can say. He is sorry. He is always sorry now. He has been sorry for 2 years, ever since he slunk home from the war. He watches his wife scoop up the baby. He keeps watching, wishing she would look at him, willing her to, always and so in need of forgiveness, but she won't. She holds the crying baby as he dresses and leaves the room. He sits for a while in the dark, listening to her soothe the baby, and then he goes outside, gets into his pickup truck, and positions the shotgun so that it is propped up and pointed at his face. In this way, he starts driving, while back in the house, Saskia is trying to understand what happened. A crack, a thud. The thud was the floor, and thank God for the ugly carpet. But what was the crack? The bed frame? The nightstand? This baby, so resilient, breathing evenly, not even a mark, somehow fine. Maybe he is one of the lucky ones, born to be okay. Saskia lies with him, then gets up and comes back with a plastic bottle of water. She drops it from the side of the bed and listens to the sound it makes as it hits the floor. She drops a pair of heavy shoes and watches them bounce. She fills a drink container with enough water to weigh about as much as the baby, and as Adam continues driving and considering the gun, not yet, not yet, not yet, not yet, she rolls that off the edge too. And look, the book goes on from there. There are, very quickly to give you some numbers, since 9/11, there are about 2.5 million Americans who have joined the various branches of service. And of the 2.5 million, about 2 million have deployed directly into either Iraq or Afghanistan or both. And I need to emphasize this. Of the 2 million, the best estimates are that 1.5 million are fine. You know, they're okay. And I know this anecdotally. In many cases, they are better for having served. But that leaves 500,000. A substantial number multiplied or now by well, added to you add wives and husbands and children and babies and parents. But 500,000 people who have come back from service with some type of mental wound. And that's a substantial number, and it's an ongoing number. It's an unfolding story, and that gets to the heart of what Thank You for Your Service is about, the story of these people trying to recover from their time in war.
Thank you. Okay. It's an extraordinary book, not just for the reporting, but also for the writing. David, in the course of these pages, is able to take us all into the lives of these individuals with such intimacy. As another reporter, I read this with great envy, the way he takes us into these scenes. To be with the Schumanns at 3 a.m. in the morning over a scene as riveting as that is quite powerful. The book is filled with these scenes. As you were setting this thing up, I was just curious. You asked the Army for a great soldier. Now, you saw... Oh, he's gone. You saw Adam in a much different state as great. Is great a measure of the Army's inability to actually discern the state of mind of Adam Shulman at that time?
Well, people in combat stress knew what was going on with him at that point. Other people perhaps didn't. It was a battalion of, like I said, 800. So different people had different things, but that they were paying attention to. Some people were paying attention to his decline. But so much of it depended on him, you know, trying to overcome. These are rough and tough guys, right? And it's not the easiest thing to say out loud, you know, maybe I need a little help. Things finally got to him to that point. But even for him to go to combat stress and ask for a little help was a huge, huge thing. And in his mind, a career ender, possibly. And on it went from there to the point where it was so interesting. When he came home, you know, he gets on a helicopter, he leaves the war, works his way back to this little airport in Manhattan, Kansas. And he gets off the plane and he's walking across the tarmac. This is it. This is his homecoming, right? Mm-hmm. After he's done with war. And as he walked across the tarmac, he was so wishing that he was missing an arm or missing a leg or wrapped in bandages or had some physical representation of being injured. Because as far as he was concerned, everybody's saying, you're wounded, man, go home. And he would look in the mirror and see perfect symmetry and not believe it himself. So that's him, his shame walking across. Meanwhile, there's Saskia, his wife, who showed up so hopeful at the airport. Here it is, the guy's home. And then it's a little airport, so you can stand against the glass and watch who's coming in. And then she sees him, and forgive me, oh shit, here it is. You know, we're in it now. And her after war was underway, where she went from this moment of hope into to out and out unrelenting fury about what had happened to her because of this war.
Yeah, I want to touch upon that.
Okay.
Now let's shift a little bit and Skip, I want you to bring your the value of having these two experts here is that we really have a wonderful opportunity to sort of as we were talking before this event, before we came out on the stage, David is presenting to us not only just the sort of the problems, what is there. Skip brings to the table a notion of solutions. So as a way of setting you up, could you tell us a little bit about it? I think you have a video that you want to show us.
Yes, I have a few slides.
And we'll step off to a side and be able to enjoy this as well.
Okay, what I've tried to do is in 5 minutes or less, try to give folks an idea about what virtual reality and how we use virtual reality as a treatment tool. I know probably a lot of you saw the title and wondered, how the heck do they do that? Isn't that what people play games with? Well, let me try to give a little bit of an idea about how we've tried to apply virtual reality to address the wounds of war. Now, this work is done the Institute for Creative Technologies at USC. We're funded partly by the Army, but we're sort of an unholy alliance between Hollywood, the military, and academia. Three completely different cultures, but somehow we get along in that building. And our group is the MedVR research group now, and it's an interdisciplinary group of folks. And our work has been, since 1995, to look at ways that we can use simulation technology for treating a wide range of clinical conditions in the psychological domain. You'll see a little bit more of this in a minute. In the cognitive domain, this is a virtual classroom we've used to test kids with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And what you're seeing here is what a child sees as they move their head in a head-mounted display. The graphics update in real time, so you create a sense of immersion in the space. Down here in the bottom is using a Microsoft Kinect, a game tool, a 3D camera. You can track that user and build physical rehabilitation activities in a VR environment so that we can make very repetitive, boring activities for rehab maybe fun and engaging by making them game-based for people after a stroke or a traumatic brain injury. And finally, one that has a little volume, our work training novice clinicians with digital patients, virtual patients.
Good afternoon, Sergeant Castilla. What brings you in today?
Well, my wife told me she thought I should talk to someone. She's been pretty concerned about me since a soldier suicided on base last week.
Did you happen to know the soldier?
Yes. He wasn't a friend, but I met the Marine once or twice. He seemed normal at the time. I guess I'm afraid I might end up like him.
So this is a partnership with the USC School of Social Work.
Do you have any plans
that has
to hurt yourself?
A master's degree program,
no.
A certificate program.
It's certainly caught my mind,
social
especially
work.
Lately.
So, in a sense,
I just need it all to
it
stop.
Gives
sometimes I can't handle it.
It's an opportunity to screw up with the digital patient.
Sergeant,
before they get
are
their
you
hands
feeling
on
depressed?
One, which is a good thing,
well,
actually,
you know,
based on my clinical training anyway. So we know we have a significant challenge on our hands, and it's been documented time and time again. What I'd like to do is show just a couple of videos of what we do in virtual reality for this type of treatment. The first video will give a little explanation. The second set of videos will show the different scenarios that we've developed and a former patient talking about his experience in the simulations. So if you notice, the clinician on the left had a control panel, and basically we have these base scenarios, 14 different scenarios, and the clinician can change the time of day, the weather conditions, introduce an IED in the distance, one under the vehicle, jets flying over, a variety of things to try to help mimic what the trauma narrative is of the patient going through it. Now, anybody who's served, I just want to forewarn that it looks like video game content, but it may be provocative. So I just want you to know that as we pop through these videos. I'd be remiss if, as a professor, I didn't show some data. And this is outcomes from the first 20 treatment completers to go through this at Camp Pendleton and at the Naval Medical Center in San Diego. At the end of treatment, 16 no longer met PTSD criteria. This is over the course of, on average, about 11 sessions. Four did not benefit from the treatment. This has been replicated a number of times, and more advanced clinical trials are ongoing. One of the goals with all this, though, we're taking an evidence-based treatment, exposure therapy, that has good clinical evidence and trying to improve on it by using the simulations with the idea that perhaps this might be a form of treatment that might appeal to a current generation of service members that have grown up digital. So, you know, in some sense, we're trying to provide a menu of options that might be right for one person but might not be right for another. And that's really the goal here. To find the right treatment for the right person with the right set of issues that the treatment can benefit. These are the places where the system is located now, and we're working on a military sexual trauma system, and we're looking towards the idea that that the things that we've learned and developed, fostered by the urgency of war, may filter down to the civilian population with new treatment tools that can address trauma in police officers, first responders, firefighters, people that have had assaults, and so forth. So we see civilian translation as one of our next steps. That's it.
So I watching this, I just have to ask, so you, at your offices out in Playa del Rey, you are just developing this technology and making it available to, I didn't see the slide, but to other Army bases and other medical centers around the country?
Yes, we're building it, and now we have an industry partner that serves as a distribution and a help desk provider. So they go around and set it up at different clinics and so on.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the next question that I have regarding this is that what's the step that follows? I mean, these are pretty... I had a chance to visit Skip and his offices out in Playa del Rey, and they're pretty... This is a pretty intense program. You put on the headsets. The chair rumbles beneath you.
Space shaker.
Yeah, so you...
Smell machine.
It's 360 degrees of exposure to this world. What is the follow up? I mean, you can take your soldiers, you can take these veterans through this sort of whiz bang digital experience, but there has to be a human touch component to it.
So absolutely, I would say that sometimes people say, oh, you're creating virtual reality therapy. I go, no, we're creating virtual reality exposure therapy. We're taking something that's already a known evidence-based approach and trying to improve upon it and create maybe a less stigmatizing approach to therapy. Now, in our work, in the research that we're involved in, we have a number of multi-site clinical trials. Typically, the follow-up period is 3 or 6 months. And the data seem to show that once you get someone over the hump at the end of treatment, as you noticed in that slide, the end of treatment, there were good outcomes, but there were continued decreases in PTSD symptoms at 3 months, and that was a significant change as well. And the idea is if you can get people over the avoidance and the numbing and maybe have some subsequent improvement in their nightmares and maybe they're less hypervigilant, that then life kind of takes over a little bit. And they start to improve because they're participating in everyday life. That's just a theory based on observation. The longest sample has been followed for 1 year, and those outcomes have been maintained as well at 1 year. But I don't think of this as the cure-all. I think this is to help give someone a leg up to get past some of the demons and then face the new demons in civilian life.
And the thought is that that a good clinician, a good psychologist who goes through this experience with a veteran will be able to elicit from the veteran his, her reactions to the video and just do their good sort of couch work.
It's a tool to extend the skills of a well-trained clinician.
Right.
It's not self-help. It's not some automated treatment to replace clinicians. And in fact, you know, it's sort of a lie here because we draw people in to maybe seek treatment because it's, oh, cool, video game. But when they're in this and after they take the headset off and you've got 30 minutes of processing what went on during the immersion session, it gets hard. It's hard medicine for a hard problem, no matter how you cut it. It's right. Trauma-focused therapy. And, you know, a lot of times people, the reason I felt it was so important to maybe show a little bit of it and the concept is that a lot of times people's first gut reaction is, why would you do that to somebody? You know, the old school, don't talk about the war in front of Bill kind of a thing. And the hard reality is that if you don't foster therapeutic exposure in some form, whether it's EMDR, it's an imagination, whether it's writing in a journal, if you don't foster engagement and processing of these trauma memories, you don't see a heck of a lot of gain. Group therapy, it's great as an adjunct to an evidence-based treatment. On its own, alone, it's not gonna have great outcomes. And that's the sad reality is a lot of places group therapy is economical. One shrink, 20 patients.
Right.
You know, on its own, it's not there. As part of a comprehensive multi-component treatment, then it can have benefit because there's more to PTSD than just a fear reaction or, you know, a hypervigilance. There's the existential trauma of war, as in the Odyssey very clearly illustrates. And in your book, you know, it's not just about, you know, avoiding places or feeling numb. There's war changes everybody.
Do you mind if I ask a question?
Yeah, please.
Okay.
Please.
So I want to know what the definition of success is. When it's a word, I hear the word a lot. I don't quite get what success means in this realm.
Well, I don't think this is a stellar achievement in psychology, but, you know, what can you measure from a human being? What they tell you, what their psychophysiology or their physiology tells you, heart rate, skin conductance, respiration, and maybe what their behavior tells you. So outcomes in the outcome research is typically a structured interview that is clinician-guided and rated, self-report checklist, symptom checklist, and that's what that data was that I showed. Startle response, where you're measuring eye blink and heart rate variability and things like that under provocative conditions. And then the real outcome is somebody able to go to work? Are they able to maintain relationships?
So functionality?
Yeah. Yeah. Everyday function in everyday life, activities of daily living, instrumental activities of daily living. But it's always, you know, in psychology, we like to be a science, like to think we're a science, but we're dealing with the hardest subject matter of all, you know, human well-being. You know, how do you put a number on that? We try. But
I also wonder how the difficulties of if this is turning out to be a worthwhile treatment, it's playing off what you said, how you get something like this into the far corners of the country. Let's be realistic. It's a lot of people who could benefit from this are not living on the West Coast or not living on the East Coast where I live. They're in many, many ways underpopulated and underserved areas of the country where not to denigrate these areas, but there are not a lot of clinicians sometimes lined up wanting to be there.
Right.
So how do you take this it just seems terrific. But how do you get it from here to there?
You know, you're talking about breaking down barriers to care, you know, making things accessible, acceptable to the patient, availability of well-trained providers, big challenge. You know, there's been a lot of work done in teletherapy. The VA has really pushed some of this, and this is where a clinician conducts therapy over an internet connection or a secure connection and does it in remote locations, typically not in the home of the veteran, but the veteran can go to a vet center where it's wired. And that data is actually quite positive that you can get as good as clinical outcomes over the wire as you can face-to-face. It's hard to believe, but it's, you know, you suspend disbelief talking to a screen, and maybe our generation does that better. But you're right. We've done everything we could to try to reduce the costs. This thing was, when we first built the first version, required two computers and expensive headset and all that. Now we've got it down to, I can run it off the laptop, can use a $350 Oculus Rift headset, which some of you may have heard about. And now there are headsets that basically house an Android phone that has inertial tracking in it and has graphic horsepower that may be the next generation, where you take your phone out, slip it in the headset, and now you're looking around, you're in a simulation, but the clinician still has to be there and has to control the ambient settings, the time of day, the weather, the sound effects, what blows up. I mean, the clinician is trying to mimic the reality of the patient as they're narrating their experience. Some patients have actually said that they feel like the clinician gets their situation better because they have to create it. They have to create it in real time in the simulation, because that's always been a criticism. You know, if you're not a veteran and you're a therapist, how the hell can you know what I'm going through? This is not the same thing. You know, the clinician didn't go through it. But the act of cooperative construction of the scenario as part of the treatment might be just a little bump up from that.
So, David, I have to ask you, the course of writing, in the course of telling the story of the veterans, and thank you for your service, you visited a number of treatment centers. One was the Haven Behavioral War Heroes Hospital, run by the Army, I believe. And the other was Pathways, an organization up in Sacramento. So much different approaches towards treating PTSD and war trauma than what Skip's talking about.
Right.
How do these dovetail?
Well, the first thing is, when Skip was talking about teleconferencing or that kind of therapy, I hadn't thought about this in a while. There was a point when I was in the 8 months I spent in Baghdad, I would take breaks once in a while. And I came home and I figured, you know, maybe I'll just check in with the shrink and see how I'm doing. So I did, went to her once. She was terrific. And I said, thanks, that was very helpful. And she said, well, we can stay in touch. And I said, well, I'm going back to Baghdad. And she said, well, we can talk over the phone. And I said, well, actually, in Baghdad, the only place I can get two bars on my cell phone is a field that's always being mortared. So I don't think this is going to work out. Made me think, it must be tough being a clinician. It's got to work. Anyway, what that's worth. So in Thank You for Your Service, there are three guys in the same unit who eventually reach the point where they overcome whatever the stigma is and realize they got to do something. It had come to that point. So without giving, it'll be too long to describe the circumstances, but here's, it comes down to this. Same unit, same war, and three guys in need of help. And one guy went to a PTSD program done by the Topeka VA. It was a 7-week in-residence program. And so basically he gets in that, and he gets 7 weeks to work it out. And another guy needs help. Look, at least there's a system now, and unlike after previous wars, there was no, you come back from Vietnam, there was no system in place. World War II, no system in place. There is a system now, but the people inside the system will be the first to acknowledge it's slapdash at times, it's ad hoc, it's overwhelmed, it's filled with good intentions and occasionally good outcomes, but not universally. So now here's the second guy who needs help, right? And the 7-week program is full and has a waiting list. So his caseworker looks around and she does find this thing in Colorado. This is not part of the VA. This is the time limits are mandated by insurance. So he gets 4 weeks. It may be a fine program, but one guy gets 7 weeks and one guy gets 4 weeks. And then the guy I showed you the photograph of, Adam Schumann, the moment comes where he's got to get some help. And the 7-week program is full. And the 4-week program is full. And so his caseworker looks around and she finally finds this little oddball thing in Northern California that's not part of the VA, that's not part of any insurance plan. It's entirely donor supported. And the guy who runs that says, yeah, he can come here, but here's the deal. 4 months minimum. And he can stay as long as it takes to work it out. So lucky Adam Schumann would tell you that the fact that he got in that place is why he's alive today. And it's not to diminish or diss the 7-week or 4-week. It's just to say that this is a system where you end up in for help is not necessarily based on specific need, specific expertise, but where there might be an opening. And I try so hard to keep opinions out of my books. And I think if you read them, you'll have no idea what I think about anything. It doesn't matter what I think. But in this case, I feel quite comfortable saying that if I had a kid who went into these wars and had served well and came home in need of help, and he was getting help in a very good 4-week program, and then I found out there was a 4-month program, I might be a little steamed about that.
How would you measure, based on what you know, how would you turn your question that you asked, Skip, how would you measure success?
Well, it's how do they measure success?
Right. What did you see of success?
Well, let's start at the most basic level. They're all still alive. There's some success in that. The war is in very much present in them as it was, but it's not overwhelming them, and it's not defining their everyday. They somehow seem to have reached the point where they're not ignoring the experience. They're recognizing it. It's a part of them, but it's not the part of them anymore. It's a part, and they're able to go down the street now, and if they see a trash pile, most days they're not thinking there's probably an EFP in that trash pile, but some days they still are, but most days they aren't. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean their marriages are better. It doesn't mean they're drinking less, although in some cases they are, but they're still alive and incrementally they're moving on.
Dave, if we had time, I'd ask you to read the final pages of Thank You for the Service, because it's a wonderful sort of coda to Adam's journey throughout this book. Skip, in the course of putting together your work, you're talking with veterans to create these scenarios.
Yeah.
You're living these experiences with these veterans that come into your offices and share with them what they've been through.
I don't actually do the treatment, so I.
Yeah. But I'm thinking that to build this, you have to understand what they've been through. While you're not treating them, you still are exposed to the rigors of combat, such as they've been through, in order to replicate it in your.
We have a very sterile term for it. It's called user-centered design. And that's where you listen to your targeted user group that you hope to have some benefit with the system that you're going to build, and build around what they report as being useful. So we built the first prototype version off of a game called Full Spectrum Warrior. We took the art assets and created a couple of streets, and we had the good fortune, one of my former grad students was being deployed as a combat operational stress control officer, and he took it with him. And I've got photos of guys sitting on the back of a military vehicle with a VR headset on, driving around, and they're kind of cool because it's like he's in virtual Iraq while he's in real Iraq. And that was the mother lode of what we got wrong. And some of the things that, you know, we had built from, you know, talking to subject matter experts. We had a lot of veterans that were here, military personnel, people still in the service that guided us initially. But we got the real boots on the ground scoop at that point. And then when my colleague Greg Rieger came back, he was stationed up at Fort Lewis, and he continued that effort. And so we got real feedback from real folks about what was relevant. Now, that was the first version, four scenarios. We were funded in 2011 because based on the good clinical outcomes to rebuild everything on new software to give it an upgrade. We built 14 worlds, and all of it is based on the feedback and on the narratives that patients gave with the original version. So, you got to keep in mind, this treatment is not passive. It's not like put on the headset and look around and you're fixed. It's, the patient needs to narrate and process their experience. And so the first time they go through, you might hear a story like, I was driving a Humvee and we hit an IED and my best friend died. Joe Friday, you know, Dragnet, just the facts. And the goal of the therapist is say, all right, let's take it back. Let's go back 15 minutes earlier. Tell me about your friend. What were you guys talking about before? And you go through it again, and you go through it again. And when you break the seal is when all of a sudden you start to see some emotionality in that story. And this is the part where the clinician has to be well-trained, because clinicians, their gut is, I want to help people. I want to hold you. You know, I don't want you to hurt. But in some sense, exposure therapy, trauma-focused treatment involves raising anxiety to a moderate level so that person doesn't avoid, and then eventually that anxiety habituates. And part of that is breaking the seal of emotion that is kept so bottled up that they don't talk to anybody about. So I forget what the question was.
No. I guess I wanted to sort of establish that both of these gentlemen have had exposure to the rigors of combat through the people that they've interviewed and spoken with. It raises a question in my mind, and I'm not sure whether this is a very well-phrased question, but reading the Odyssey and reading the Iliad, we're reminded, of course, that war has been a part of the human experience since the dawn of time, literally. And it makes me wonder whether what's the problem here? Is it so much the nature of war, or is it the nature of our society that has made it so difficult for veterans returning from combat?
This is a hard one to answer. I'd like you to take the first shot at it, because I might get into trouble if I say what I think.
No, because I'm gonna try to turn the question into something else. So I think you ought to take a shot at it before I remove it entirely.
Play for time.
I think PTSD might be enhanced, or might be more a higher probability of it in a civilization that cherishes life, that death, unreasonable death, is not a good thing. You can say that our society, you know, we're numb to it, the types of movies we watch and so on, but I think there's also we value life, and when you really feel death, it's not just like, oh yeah, that happened, you know, that happens, it's life. When you feel it in your gut, when a brother, sister goes down, I think there may be, and I know there's 1,000 holes you can shoot in the argument, but I think society, as civilization progresses, you're going to see higher levels of stress responses to trauma than you would have in this civilization 100 years ago, 50 years ago. I think humanity is evolving.
So now I'll change the question up, if you don't mind. What I'd like to do is, I actually would like to read one more paragraph.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
You know, when you talk, we're talking about the Odyssey, we're talking about previous wars, we're talking about this war. These are works of journalism. There's nothing, you know, it's journalism, but there are no headlines here. We all know at some level, war transforms, war degrades, war causes moral injury. But I want to point out two things. This, this isn't history. This is ongoing now. These are the newest characters in this eons old drama of war and recovery from war. And this is not a done deal by any means. It's a current unfolding story. And the other part of it is these, and we know this, these are unpopular wars and they've been largely ignored wars. And most of us don't have a sense of what has been so specifically traumatizing. What specifically are they trying to recover from? And that's the paragraph I want to read. It's a paragraph of specifics.
And just quickly before you get to that, are you getting at sort of the distance between sort of civilian life and military life? The distance between myself as I go about my everyday life and actually what's occurring to these soldiers?
No, I'm not saying it's any way defined or exaggerated by distance. I'm just saying to some people who may not know what the deal is every day but think they know, I want to read a paragraph about what the deal was every day.
Good.
And it's not that they've come home and they feel somewhat separated from civilian society because of the growing gap between the two. This is much more specific. It's not good. It's not because of the reaction they got. It's because of what's they did or didn't do or saw that's so defining of what day-to-day recovery is like. So here's the paragraph, and this is you know, what happened to them. The paragraph is this. They are these soldiers, they are these recovering people. They are the ones home from a war where every day would begin the same way. The soldiers would tuck Lucky Charms into their pockets. And again, we're talking about the transformation of 19 and 20-year-olds, okay? First deployment, not most like Schumann, third deployment. We're talking about young people with invincibility, and this is what happened. They are the ones home from a war where every day would begin the same way. The soldiers would tuck Lucky Charms into their pockets and joke about their final words. They would gather in quick circles to pray and smoke the last cigarette of their lives. They would tighten their body armor, push in their earplugs, lower their shatter-resistant sunglasses, and tug on their burn-resistant gloves. And when someone called out, "Let's go," they would climb into their Humvees and go, knowing full well what was waiting for them down the road. They had seen Harrelson's Humvee rise into the air and burst into fire. They had seen Emery get shot in the head and collapse in his own spreading blood. They had seen soldiers lose legs, lose arms, lose feet, lose hands, lose fingers, lose toes, and lose eyes. And they had heard them, too, in the aid station, in whatever pain is enough pain to make a 19-year-old scream. They had heard a soldier ask, "Is anything sticking out of my head?" after a mortar attack. They had heard a doctor say, I'm hoping, about a soldier who in a few minutes would be dead. They had heard a soldier tell a dying soldier as he stuffed what was left of him into a Humvee, "You're going to have to move your feet so I can close the door." They had heard a soldier who had lost his right leg and left leg and right arm and most of his left arm saying, "Ow, it hurts." They had heard a sergeant who was watching something skid across the floor of the aid station, which had fallen from a shredded soldier who was about to die, say with sadness, "That's a toe." Most of all, they had heard explosion after explosion and seen dozens of Humvees disappear into breathtaking clouds of fire and debris. And by the end, most of them had been inside such a cloud themselves, blindly feeling around in those initial moments to determine if they were alive or dead or intact or in pieces as their ears rang and their hearts galloped and their souls darkened and their eyes occasionally filled with tears. So they knew. And yet day after day, they would go out anyway, which eventually came to be what the war was about. Not winning, not losing, nothing so grand. Just trying, and then trying again until it was time to come home and discovering that life after the war would be very much the same. A life about trying. So these are the specifics of this battalion, and this is what's going on in Kansas and communities across the country. It's the old story, but it's the current story of recovering from that. It's abnormal, but it became so normal to them when they were there. And then bingo, you get on a plane and you come home, and now you get to try to get back into normal patterns when what's become so normal for you is the abnormal.
Yeah. That's well stated. I think what's interesting about your book is not only that these efforts belong not just to the veterans themselves, but also to their families. The portrait of Saskia, Adam's wife, is almost as sort of harrowing as Adam's. She's going through as much of a shock to the war as he experienced in the war.
Sure, and look at this widow named Amanda Doster. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody has this. It's and maybe you can help me. Well, maybe it's easy to understand. But no matter how well they did, there's some, just like Adam had, some sense of private guilt or shame. And at the end of the day, there's no louder conversation than the one you have with yourself about your own shame. And the case of this widow, Amanda Doster, I mean, it's 3 years after she lost her husband. And everybody is saying, her best friends are saying, enough already. You know, just move on. And she wants to move on. And there's this scene in the book where, you know, here she is driving around Kansas, and she gets to a stoplight, and she looks at the car next to her, and it's a pest control truck. And she looks at the driver. It's her husband. And she gets it. He didn't die. He didn't like the war. And he came home, and he snuck out of the war, and now he's in Kansas, and he's laying low, and he's working pest control and saving money, and as soon as the coast is clear, he's going to come home and ring the doorbell, the same doorbell they rang to say he was dead, and there he'll be. Great. And then the light changes, and she shakes her head, and it's another day of trying to recover and feeling privately ashamed that she can't recover from this thing.
Trying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're nice people.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? What war books had you read?
Oh my God!
That might have influenced how you've done this, like All Quiet in the Western Front.
Yeah. That I read the sequel, and I learned from the sequel that sequels don't sell as well as the original books. Quick, name the title of the sequel, right? World War One stuff, World War Two stuff, a lot of Vietnam stuff. And a lot of policy books and memoir about the beginning of the war. So it was all there kind of rattling around in me. But as soon as I got to Baghdad, you know, I put all that aside. I didn't want to be anywhere near a war book while I was there in the war. But you know, you want to go in this. They were naive. I was naive, right? I didn't know what I was getting into, I guess. And you don't want to go into it stupidly. You want to prepare. Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, part of the deal is you read deeply and widely to learn as much as you can before you go.
So we talk a lot about the veterans as they return. Skip, if I have it right, you're involved in sort of perhaps a fledgling program, or perhaps not so fledgling, that is involved in trying to identify soldiers who might be more vulnerable before they go to combat. Strive?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. There's a lot of talk about resilience, and when we talk about the 500,000 veterans who are suffering from PTSD, and the other what is it 1.5 million that are seemingly carrying on, you know, we wonder. I often wonder, as with most mental health issues and trauma, whether some people are more physiologically, mentally, neurologically vulnerable to trauma in ways that we don't necessarily see until the trauma exists. Your program, if I understand, is try to identify people that might be more susceptible to trauma and the after effects of it. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Well, briefly, I mean, what we try to do is we had built this giant collection of digital assets for the exposure therapy element. And we started looking at it like, well, we've got the back lot of Universal Studios for an immersive interactive narrative, and we could play out activities in this world. So we started to build episodes of an interactive narrative where you put on the headset and you're embedded within a squad before you go on your first deployment. And you know, instead of watching Band of Brothers on the couch, you're in the Band of Brothers episodes. You get to know the characters and so on. And we nicknamed it the Emotional Obstacle Course, because at the end of each episode, something bad happens. The bad thing that happens is based on the types of stories that we were hearing in the therapy. And so that sort of gives somebody a little bit of an anticipation of what could happen, but we didn't stop there. We looked at that as a setup for teaching resilience, rather than throwing a book at somebody and saying, here are the stress management tactics that'll help you in war, that somebody will read the first page and put down. We actually put them in the episode, had them experience these things, and then a virtual human mentor, a character, comes out and guides them through deep breathing exercises or teaches them about cultural relativity. There's some things you can't change in a culture or you have to be able to live with, or cognitive restructuring, how you think about things sometimes in faulty ways during times of stress. Let's reevaluate what just went on in the scene. And so we've done that as a resilience training tool, and we're testing it now. We put a unit that left out of Colorado in March through it, and they're in Afghanistan now. They come back in December, so we'll be testing them and seeing what impact we have. But the element that you're talking about is, how do you detect somebody that might be more susceptible? And so what we've been doing in parallel with this is drawing bloods from people before they go into the scenarios to look for biomarkers that can be derived from the blood. And this is my colleagues. I don't have the brain power to understand all the elements, but you know, the elements of cortisol and DHEA, all these things, to look at how does that relate to how people react in the scenarios in terms of their heart rate, their skin conductance, respiration, and then follow them and see who runs into trouble later on, and then go back and look for what were the predictors. Is there something that we can predict from something beforehand? Now, some people say, well, geez, you know, what if you traumatize somebody before war, you know, in these simulations? And I say, well, if you're going to get traumatized in the simulation, maybe it's better to find out now than when you're there. And I firmly believe, through no fault of a person's own, how their nervous system is wired. You know, it's just, if you can spot somebody that is hypervigilant to begin with, or is going to not have this ability to go through something bad and feel horrible, but eventually adapt over time. I like to say that PTSD is like, think of the worst heartbreak you ever had, a death in a family, or your girlfriend breaking up before the junior prom or something with you. And think of how bad you felt right then. But imagine that doesn't go away. 6 months, you still feel as bad. Right. A year later, you still feel. That to me is what I see as the enduring impact of PTSD. And if we can spot that in people, whether it's genetics, whether it's blood draws, whether it's what they tell you after they go through something, whatever that data is that we can collect, that's what we want to try to.
And also to condition soldiers to recognize what lies ahead of them. I just came back from a reporting trip to Fort Riley, and the joke that was sort of going on the base is that a lot of these soldiers play Call of Duty, and as one of the wives told me, the joke was that they have to remind their husbands that there's no respawning, which I guess is the aspect of Call of Duty where you come back to life after you've been killed. There's no respawning in combat. You know, death is death, and that's final. We're coming close to the end, so I want to ask one more question of David here before, but we'll then pass the mic around and come to questions here. It seems appropriate that we should just sort of talk quickly, David, about Thank You for Your Service. The title, a certain sort of irony associated with that.
It wasn't meant to be.
Well, explain. It.
All right. Well, the story behind the title is when I turned in the book, I had a different title. That title was The Suicide Room. And my publisher said, oh, that's just a great title. Thank you.
It's going to fly off the shelves.
Yeah, she said, if you're trying to put us out of business, so try to come up with something better. And so I rattled around. I finally came up with this because it's such a ubiquitous phrase, right? Thank you for your service. Thank you for your service. And everybody liked it. She liked it. The guy who runs the place liked it. Marketing liked it. Everybody liked it except for me because I was concerned that it might come across as overly ironic or bitter, or as if the author is saying thank you for your service, and that would quarrel with the work I do. Finally, I came around to liking the title for the simplest of reasons. It comes down to this. How do I explain it simply? Look, if you read the book. no, and I'm not making a play to read the book. I just don't know how to. If you read the thing, you'll have a much clearer idea of who exactly you're thanking and what exactly you're thanking.
But we were also talking about sort of the limitations that the gut reaction of civilian America is to turn to a serviceman and say thank you for your service,
right,
and feel that has covered the distance between helping this soldier home or acknowledging it, when in fact it takes a little bit more than that. Or
some soldiers that I know, they thank you for your service, they'll say thanks, okay, buy me a drink, pal, and it seems like a clean transaction. But most of the ones I know actually find it an increasingly empty phrase because there's no specific knowledge underneath it. It's a statement. Thank you for your service with very little understanding underneath. And what I found is what the soldiers or the ex-soldiers now seem most grateful for is when there's actual attention paid and the understanding of what they might have gone through, rather than this assumption that very quickly is comes down to a thank you for your service and the transaction moves on.
And as I discovered, so many of these gestures that we extend to soldiers is done mostly for the benefit of society, to help us make us feel better for what we put these soldiers through, rather than help the soldiers actually feel more integrated with their society around them.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see what questions we have in the audience. If we could, a change of lighting. That's refreshing.
That is nice.
Okay. Yeah, please. And just as a caveat, keep your questions short. This isn't a therapy session, so just get to a question quickly, and we'll be able to get good response from our...
Thank you for this discussion. It's fascinating. But I noticed that Adam sort of represents an older version of the soldier, where I think we were much more in tune with the military. But today's soldier in an all-volunteer army comes from a very different socioeconomic background and probably even a gender than they had back in World War II and even Vietnam. Can you comment a bit on the socioeconomic variations that occur nowadays that wouldn't have occurred in previous battles or wars?
Well, okay, so it's, some of your answers in your question. And I should point out that in the first book I did, it's an infantry battalion, so just by definition and limits, everybody was male, because that's the way infantry is at this point. The second book is women do show up, thank heavens, in the central roles. It's a volunteer army. It's not a draft. It's a professional army. That said, It's not a secret that if I think it's fair to say they're disproportionate. It's not a clean geographical bar graph across the country, however you want to put it. Many, many more soldiers, especially enlisted soldiers, especially at this point in 2007, were coming from economically depressed areas where this was a pretty good option. And by the way, the bonuses were great and often tax-free. I don't want to be crass and just suggest that the only reason people were joining up was for economic reasons. Plenty of these guys had a sense of mission, and I think it's fair to say, especially at the beginning, patriotism. But that's the demographic we're talking about, especially the guys I knew best, the ones from 2007. Here's the other way to underscore it. 2007 was an extraordinary year because the waiver rate hit 19% that year, which meant that 19% of the people joining, I don't know if this is Army or across the military, I think it was Army that year, they needed some kind of waiver to get in, which means they had some pre-existing, maybe it was drug use. There were a few cases I know of people who had been convicted of homicides. There were mental instabilities, but there was a war underway, and the Army had to hit its numbers to fight this war. And so to hit those numbers, the waiver rate was 19%, which basically means one in five guys getting in other times would not have been allowed to serve. And that's really interesting. That said, don't generalize, because I saw some of those waiver rates become extraordinary young men by the end of the deployment. And I saw guys who started out as you just would have thought, you know, if you're a betting man, my money's on that guy to be great. and not so much. Schumann is a pretty good example here because he came from a tough background. He didn't have a lot of options after high school. He had drifted around, tried things on, didn't like anything, joined the military, and became quite a great human being, and then ultimately quite a flawed human being.
Yeah, we have a question over here.
Yes, I have a comment and a question. I volunteered at the base where people can go and read letters that private citizens write to soldiers. And everybody can write a letter to a soldier thanking him or her for the service. And packages are collected, and it's very nice. But I want to say that people wrote such touching letters to soldiers. My daughter and I would cry, you know. So it's I felt like I can write such a letter because I can express my thanks to the person who goes and volunteers at war. But my question is to the psychiatrist. I don't understand how this post-traumatic syndrome is cured with the visionary game. To me, it seems like it's like they're living through the drama all over again. Is my understanding correct? So would it be like if somebody was at the concentration camp, it's like when they see, they would go through the same experience again and again and become numb to that? Is that how it's done? Like, if you, and how would the rape victim be treated? You say that, so like they would go through the same experience over and over again. Maybe I misunderstood something. Sure.
I don't think we try to make people numb. We try to help them process their experience in a way that they can move forward from it. You know, there's a conditioning and learning element of it, that there's this dysfunctional association between something that happened in the past and an emotional state now that gets triggered by walking down the street or you're going into a crowded department store or something. And part of it is to help a person go through their experience again. And they do it repetitively, and sometimes it becomes more boring than frightening over time. But it provides an opportunity for somebody to actually talk about and process things in a safe environment with a clinician that knows how to pull some of these things out of you that you don't say to anybody. You don't discuss publicly. You don't go through that act of processing. So I lean more towards this cognitive side where it's not just conditioning. It's about helping a person to talk about their experience in a way that is hopefully curative or healing anyway.
And not re-traumatizing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Question? My question is to the author, David. I'm curious. I mean, I think it's been obvious to many of us for a long time that there's a socioeconomic disparity because of the way we have an army set up, our military service set up these days. But with these people who've gone through it, who went in for a variety of reasons, economic as well as patriotism, what are their views after getting, I mean, you were embedded with them for months. What are their views about the situation after they've served? And what would they say to a younger brother or friend or somebody? Would they recommend that somebody join the military? I mean, what are their personal views? What are their political views? Do they change?
Well, I want to be careful about generalizing. You have a battalion of 800 guys. You're going to have 800 stripes of reactions and opinions. Within that caution, based on the work I've done with this unit, I feel comfortable saying that when they came back, a few came back thinking in grand terms that they had made a difference and they were helping win the war. And a few came back thinking in grand terms that that was just a waste of time and it meant nothing at all. But the vast majority came back not concerned with either of those things, much more concerned with what happened to me, and who did I become, and how, what now? It was a much more specific thing. It wasn't. And when person after person would say that to me, I thought that was, you know, privately, I thought that was pretty healthy, that they weren't trying to explain what happened to them or what might have happened to them in terms of a grand narrative, but very specifically, as much as they were allowed to or capable of doing it, thinking the hard thoughts about their own selves. And it's been interesting lately with what's happening now in Iraq. That's from the notes and the letters I'm getting from these guys. That seems to be shifting a bit. And it's not because they're done thinking about themselves, but because what's going on now is just so extraordinary. And now they are thinking in the larger terms of what was that about? Why did we do that? And we were talking earlier, and I was trying to make the point that it seems to have moved from a kind of specificity into more of a sentimentality about the whole thing. And maybe that's necessary, and maybe that's part of healing, but I kind of like these it better when they were thinking specifically about their own selves rather than becoming a bit sentimental about the whole thing.
Over here.
Dr. Rizzo, you mentioned your medical virtual reality program is in large part auditory and visual stimuli. You also talked about vibrating seats and a smell machine. Can you elaborate on that a little bit, please?
Yeah, basically, I think the visuals in head mount display set a place. They put you in a place. The sounds really drive emotion. And we've got a large library of sound that's at the disposal of the clinician to interleave into the simulations, the call of prayers. Sometimes that, when that goes on, that really activate someone. We have sound clips of babies crying, crowd sounds, things like that. Find the sound really is emotionally evocative. Now, the Bass Shaker platform, we run the sound through it, so you feel the motor of the Humvee or a bomb goes off, you feel it. I think that is a visceral driver. The sense of smell, well, you know, sense of smell for some folks, since the smell goes to the part of the brain that mediates emotion and memory, for some folks, we've seen the second that first puff comes out of the machine, they're upright. And, you know, they're not good smells. They're diesel fuel, rotting garbage, burning rubber, body odor, cordite, gunpowder, things like that. So, you know, basically, we try to put together all these things to create a simulation that will activate emotion so we can begin to work with that. And I think it's everyone has a little bit of a different reactivity to each one of those things, depending on what they went through. So we try to cover all the bases.
Let's.
I'll be here after.
Yeah, let's go. Two more questions from the audience. We'll all have a chance. David will be signing his book outside. Skip will be out there as well, so you have a chance to talk with him. I encourage that. But for our general edification, let's go to another question here.
Next question right here.
Thank you. Thank you. I come from the Vietnam era. A lot of men I knew served there, and there was a lot of many lessons learned from that time about PTSD also. Particularly the work of Jonathan Shea about working, and his book then, Achilles in Vietnam, Ulysses in Vietnam, it's like deja vu all over again to hear what's happening now. I'm wondering, from your experience in Iraq, what has the Army done since Vietnam time to systematically make for every soldier a different experience that's kind of folded into their experience there, where they're dealing with their trauma as it's happening, and making changes in the way they help soldiers come back? To hear you say this man came back alone from the airport in Kansas by himself is like, well, wait, didn't we learn something 20 years ago? 40 years ago? How long? 50 years ago. So sorry.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty lonesome business, this after war. It turns out there's this line in the book, something like, if the truth of war is that you end up ultimately being in it for the guy next to you, the truth of the after war is you're pretty much on your own. And it's you're asking a difficult question because what should the military be required to do? You know, the main thing the military was doing in 2007 was trying to fight a war with enough people to fight, whether we agree with the strategy or not, carry out that strategy they had. And so if somebody was offline for whatever reason, what they were trying to do is either get them out or get them ready to go back online so they can keep fighting the war. There's a, one general who I've spent a lot of time with, a guy named Pete Corelli, who was a four-star who was helping run the war in Iraq, and then he came home and he was promoted to vice chief of staff and very sincerely took on mental issues and suicide and things like that. He ended up wondering, it sure would be nice if the VA in its own way could get inside the Pentagon more and be involved in the very things you're asking about. Don't leave it up to the military, but leave it up to the people who are responsible for who comes out of the military. And if only they could get along a little better, which is, if you know anything about how things work, it's a lovely dream.
Yeah. You know? I think, you're dealing with a bureaucracy that has a short memory, too. And there are changes, there are positive changes, but they're not implemented so visibly or so well. One of the most positive changes I've seen is this attitude towards resilience, where you have General Casey, writing in the journal American Psychologist about how psychological fitness needs to be elevated to the same level as physical fitness. And that's recognition that, that didn't happen before. I mean, maybe a good staff sergeant or a good commander would recognize that. But now it's doctrine. And it's taken 40, 50 years since Vietnam for people to really not just acknowledge it, but now start to implement it with some of these efforts at resilience, which, some are good, some are, showcase kind
of thing. Right. Yeah, sometimes doctrine, it becomes a game of telephone. As it goes down the line, it gets more and more misinterpreted, but sometimes not.
And our last question, yes.
Hi, I have two questions, but one of them is super quick. I wonder if you'll indulge me. And the first one was for Dr. Riz. I was just wondering, I know that like exposure therapies in particular can be really intense for clinicians. I know a lot of clinicians that only will schedule like maybe two prolonged exposure clients per day because they just mm-hmm. need some time to recoup after that. And I'm just wondering if there's been any study in terms of whether the secondary trauma to clinicians is increased with the virtual reality, or if that's been...
That study hasn't been done yet. Okay. I'm not sure how that would play out.
Okay.
Joking around with my friends, I say we can take a mediocre prolonged exposure therapist and make him a superstar with virtual reality, because exposure therapy requires this real intense focus and being able to feel the emotion, but then know what the next thing is to say to help guide the patient in a therapeutic way towards mm-hmm. dealing with their own emotion. Really, it's really challenging. Mm-hmm. Maybe if you have a tool and you're comfortable with the tool, you can focus on what that next push is going to be. As far as secondary PTSD, there's no data with this. Mm-hmm. We're still at the stage of showing that it has some value mm-hmm. for the patients. And which, by the way, when I say patients, that's just a habit. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if anybody has a view, if you notice in my slide, I said PTS, exposure therapy, post-traumatic stress. My colleagues in psychiatry say, no, it's a disorder and that helps us with insurance and this and that. But in some sense, I leave it to you guys. Is it a disorder or is it just, for some folks, a natural reaction to hellacious, horrible circumstances? And we should just say, we're treating post-traumatic stress. We're not treating, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, because I fall on both sides of it sometimes.
I think that's perhaps a good note to conclude. Maybe you can ask your second question when we step outside. But I do want to give you all a chance to get copies of the book, meet David, get it signed, talk to Skip, find out a little bit more, follow-up questions or otherwise. But thank you so much for showing up tonight.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.